Everybody deals with major distractions every dang day of our lives, but especially at Christmas. Because invariably, the opening line for every conversation about, I don't know, December 10th or so, is, "You ready for Christmas?" And though ready could mean a lot of things, everybody instantly knows what ready means at Christmas. It means done with your shopping. And as a pastor, can I make a confession to you? That royally honks me off. Because the truly important readiness that ought to enjoy tip-top priority gets passed over even by those of us who desperately love Jesus, simply because the urgency of gift buying distracts us from what this season is really all about. And what should matter most gets buried under a pile of other stuff that needs done, but not nearly as much as the thing we just buried. My favorite example of Christmas distraction is a true story about my own crew when my now fully grown kids were back in elementary school. Because in our family, we observed a very solemn Christmas tradition. We would come home after Christmas Eve service, and after opening one package each that always contained the exact same thing, pajamas, we'd huddle around the nativity, because the stable of our nativity was a treasured copy of a family heirloom that I grew up with, and so did my mom before me, and now my grandkids. And so we'd plop down around that very old stable, and we would reenact the real Christmas. Everybody was assigned a part to play. Either mom or dad would read Luke 2. Andrea would be Joseph and Mary, or maybe Gabriel. Jess would be the shepherds and the wise men, and Josh would get to be baby Jesus, and then next year we'd switch it up. And this tradition was such a hit that weeks before the big night, distraction, because the kids would start debating, insert arguing, about whose turn it was this year to be baby Jesus. For the most part, it was a fun kind of banter, but one year it got ugly. Because Jess was convinced it was her turn to be baby Jesus. And though I explained that it was actually Josh's turn, she wouldn't let it go. Instead, at every meal, she'd launch into another tirade about how it was her turn, and it's not fair because Josh got to be baby Jesus last year. No, Jess, Andrea was, but it's my turn. I want to be baby Jesus. In fact, she got so angry that before we left for Christmas Eve service, my daughter kidnapped baby Jesus, stole him right out of the manger, hid him in her nightstand. Needless to say, when I found out, our kids got a second Christmas Eve sermon that year. Well, here's the thing. Jess isn't the only one to kidnap Jesus. We all do it. We get so caught up in meal prep and gift lists and decorating and wrapping and the never-ending parties and programs, we get practically everything ready for the divine invasion of Jesus to planet Earth, except our hearts. Oh, we know the Christmas story. We revel in the miracle of the God-child who came to bring redemption that only he could provide through a plan conceived before creation, one that carried him from a coarse cradle all the way to a cruel cross. We know the story. But far too many of us who know the Christ child, even though we love him, for most of this season, we ignore him. And instead, we nab him and stick him in a drawer. Now, distraction can disrupt way more than just Christmas. The tyranny of the urgent and the daily grind of life can wreak havoc on whatever dream, whatever calling or vision you have for your life, because let's face it, bills need paid. Work is never done. And so it's easy, isn't it, to lose sight of the most important things of life simply because some other good thing is screaming so loudly it drowns out the plaintive call of a greater thing. To the point that we allow secondary responsibilities to rob us of life's most important responsibility. In Nehemiah chapter 6, I want to unpack what I see is three very common distractions. We're going to talk about opportunities, criticism, and fear. Because Nehemiah faced all three in spades, as he attempted to complete that wall around Jerusalem. I share them because I believe that they're still the primary distractions everybody has to face whenever we try to do whatever it is that God has called us to do. You may remember from last week that we found Nehemiah dealing with yet another cycle of civil unrest. Once he got that mess worked out and everybody was on the same page again, it was really cool. Within days, the majority of the heavy lifting was done and the wall was nearly built. In fact, all that remained was hanging a couple of doors. And dude, this project is a wrap. Look, when word came to Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem, and our other enemies that I had rebuilt the wall and not a gap was left, though I hadn't yet set those doors, meaning things were really looking up, Nehemiah's trio of enemy stooges start stirring the pot all over again. Sanballat, the ringleader, realizing that Nehemiah was about to complete this mammoth project, was both amazed and ticked. So Sani, Toby, and Geshi huddle up and devise a new plan, namely, we're going after Nehemiah personally. Thinking correctly, I believe, that if they could distract the leader, they could disrupt, if not grind to a halt altogether, the project God had called Nehemiah to do. So, Sanballat and Geshem sent Nehemiah this message. Come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. Now, the plan, as we saw last time, was that Nehemiah would be pulled off the project, he'd get separated from his team, and then they would kill him. And though initially Nehemiah didn't know about the plan, he still responded to their invite to come to the summit at Ono with a very decided, oh no, I'm not going to go to Ono. Think I'm a schmo? All he knew was they wanted a powwow, probably figuring that they wanted to have a peace agreement. After all, he's almost done with the wall, so they'll probably want to normalize relations again because we're back. Jerusalem is on the rise. But in fact, they intended to do me harm. So I sent messengers saying, I'm doing a great work and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? And they sent this to me four times. And I answered in the same way. Is that not the greatest reply ever? I am doing a great work and I cannot come down. Now, I want you to humor me by repeating that statement both loud and proud, okay? Because this week you're probably going to need this same response if you plan to get through Christmas without sticking Jesus in a drawer. Are you ready? Okay, let's say it. That didn't convince me, right? Let's try it again. Mean it this time. Bring to mind whatever distraction has been pulling you off task and say it defiantly this time. Let's do it. All right. Now memorize that. Nehemiah knew that he was doing a God thing, a really important thing. He even called it a great thing. So he didn't have time to attend a meeting. Meetings are for people who talk about getting things done, not those who actually get stuff done. So rather than get distracted, Nehemiah stayed on focus because he wanted to be relentless about this great work God had called him to do. Now, taking a break to meet with Sanballat wasn't a bad thing. Making peace with your enemy is normally considered a good thing, right? But God had called Nehemiah above every other priority to rebuild that wall. So going to a meeting, as far as Nehemiah was concerned, was a distraction. Good thing, because peace wasn't at all what Sanballat had in mind. But here we go, because I want to show you these three types of distraction that Nehemiah had to face. Distractions that you're going to also have to confront if you're going to do what you believe God has called you to do. And here's the first one. Opportunities. Every single day, opportunities come along that have the potential to distract you from what God has called you to do. Entertainment opportunities, athletic opportunities, financial opportunities, relationship opportunities, investment opportunities, business opportunities, vacation opportunities. The list is endless. Now, for me, the opportunities that hold the greatest potential to distract me are typically very good opportunities, things I could justify: a planning meeting, counseling session, a speaking engagement, a community function, a seat on a mission board. Dude, I could be churning 6 nights a week. I could be writing 8 hours a day if I said yes to just the good opportunities that come my way. I could be even busier than I already am, and in the process, make far less progress in doing the very few things I know God has tapped me out and put me here to do. So, like Nehemiah, I've learned I need to work smarter, not harder. Can I be real with you? Ministry is the best profession I know for psychopaths. Seriously, most pastors have never learned how to distinguish between activity and accomplishment. Never have they been busier in their lives than they are right now. Yet never have they accomplished so little. They're knocking themselves out, working morning, noon, and night to the point their kids think they're Santa Claus because they only see him on Christmas morn. Yet, what's happening? Well, all these good opportunities are depleting the reserves that God gave you to fulfill His opportunities. A wise man once said that a fanatic is someone who redoubles his efforts after he loses sight of the goals. Which reminds me of a true story of a missionary down in Brazil who loves to describe, still to this day, in vivid detail, how it takes him 3 days to canoe back into the jungle where he serves. Missionary Aviation Fellowship, a ministry that flies missionaries into the fields where they serve at no cost, when they heard about all that canoeing, they went to the missionary and said, "We will fly you at no cost. We'll get you there in 3 hours instead of 3 days." You know what this missionary said? "No thanks. This is what God has called me to do." And so he canoes 3 days in and 3 days out, 6 days in a canoe. Why? So he can come back to America and tell his supporters, "It takes me 6 days." Which is great if your objective is canoe riding. Paddle away, baby. But to me, that's just plain stupid. At one time, there were no options. But now, okay, would it be okay if I spread a little guilt around right now? I mean, we're already here, right? Before Jesus left us, he gave us a mission. He told us to go make disciples of all nations. And then just before he ascended into heaven, he gave us the strategy for how we're to do it. He stood up on Mount of Olives, he looked out across Jerusalem, and he said, "You must be my witnesses, and I want you to start here, but ultimately I want you to take my message to the ends of the earth." And that's still our mission. We are called as Jesus' disciples to be disciples that make disciples. That's why our church mission says we lead people to follow Jesus. And when we fail to advance that mission, folks, we lose our muscle. When we fail to fulfill our purpose, we lose our power, but even more, our reason for existing. So, with that, how come we still have ornaments on that tree out there? Is it because evangelism is optional? Now, I hesitate to go here because whenever we started the Crossroads, our vision was that when we gather here, we're not going to beat people up, we're going to build people up. But folks, if Jesus' world mission is truly our most vital mission, Even though it's impossible for any one person to do the job, to be able to invest in the lives of the thousands of people that live here in the North Valley so that multitudes can come by faith to Jesus simply because somebody took the time to care for them, what each of us can do and what I want to challenge you to do is to invest over the course of this next year in at least one. Just one somebody in 2017. With the goal of building into that one somebody so that by God's grace, you might actually be able to lead that person to faith in Jesus. Because if everybody, folks, listen to me, if everybody in our church accepted that one challenge to bring just one somebody to Jesus every 12 months, our church would grow so exponentially, we would need 40 new buildings. And wouldn't that be awesome. And most of us really want that. But then, you know, we got the hobby thing, an entertainment thing, and season ticket thing. And it distracts us from the primary reason we breathe. Please don't do that. Instead, like Nehemiah, when other opportunities, even good ones, present themselves, learn to say, I am doing a great work, and I cannot come down. Just imagine. Just get creative. Have a foursome that goes out every week, except two are believers and two are non-believers. Wow. Or a card night, and every believer is required to bring an unbeliever. It could be 1,000 different things, but time is spent, laughter is shared, walls start to fall, and spiritual conversations erupt, and then a slender thread of faith begins to unfurl. Subtly at first, but there's no denying it's there, and miraculously, even though it might seem spontaneously, it never is. A life is forever changed, and then another, simply because you and I decided to do for one what we wish we could do for everyone. So, here's the thing. I know you can't complete that kind of circuit in 6 days, but you could make a first move by grabbing an ornament and inviting someone you care to come. Because that's the great work, and we've been called to it. Please do not let this last frenzied week before Christmas distract you. All the stuff you're planning to do and hoping to buy and wanting to bake and wrap and make ready and blah, 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 blah. It's good. It is. But the work Jesus called us to do isn't just good, it is great. Please don't let the good opportunities rob you. The second distraction that Nehemiah faced was criticism. Something Nehemiah was probably getting used to by now, except the criticisms weren't aimed at his workers or his vision. Now the criticisms were being aimed directly at him, mostly in the form of false accusations. You see, Sanballat sent Nehemiah the same invite five back-to-back-to-back-to-back-to-back times. The first four times, Nehemiah responded with, okay, one person got it. All right, work on that. But the fifth time came in the form of just an invite, more than just that. This time, Sanballat sent his aide with the same message, and in his hand was an unsealed letter in which was written, "It is reported among the nations, and Geshem says it's true." Whoa! What preacher hadn't heard that line? Pastor, I don't like what you're doing. And I've heard other people don't like it either. Well, there you go. That line is as old as Nehemiah himself. But it is reported that you and the Jews are plotting to revolt, and therefore you're building the wall. Moreover, according to these reports, you're about to become their king and have even appointed prophets to make this proclamation. There is a king in Judah. Now, this report is going to get back to the king, so come, let us confer together. In that day, letters were written on either papyrus or leather, and then the sender would roll up the writing material, tie it with a string, and seal it with clay. But this letter was sent open. Sanballat purposely neglected to seal the letter. Why? So that its contents could be read by everyone who handled it along the way. So his goal, clearly, was to start a rumor that Nehemiah was declaring himself as Judah's new king, although nothing could be further from the truth. But see, people aren't typically interested in the truth, especially if the news is juicy. But if word got out that Nehemiah was preparing to make himself king, he'd have wholesale rebellion on his hands. For one thing, his people really didn't want to part with Persia. And even if they had, if the rumor ever reached Artaxerxes, the king would have lopped off Nehemiah's head so fast he wouldn't know it till he sneezed. Either way, Nehemiah would be a goner, and that's really all Sanballat wanted. Who killed him was of little concern. So given this opposition, who wouldn't understand had Nehemiah started playing defense? After all, his life was the one that was at stake. Kings were understandably suspicious of governors whose aspirations had gone to their heads, and workers on the wall were always looking for a reason to quit working on the wall. Yet Nehemiah stayed focused. He didn't even take time to defend himself. He didn't worry about how the king might respond or what if the workers decide to quit. He just kept working toward what he knew God wanted him to do. And he sent to Nehemiah this reply: "Nothing like what you're saying is happening. You're just making it up out of your head." Nehemiah knew the score. Sanballat and company were just trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. Don't you love it? Instead of chasing rumors and dodging false accusations, Nehemiah turned his attention to the one who led him to launch this project in the first place, and therefore the only one who could protect him no matter what may come. And instead, Nehemiah, look at this, he prayed, "God, strengthen my hands." It never fails. Nothing brings critics out of the woodwork quite like a new vision, especially if you're passionate about whatever it is yet to be. Somebody's going to step up and criticize you and question your motives, because people who don't have a vision don't understand people who do. They're just not accustomed to a leader who's willing to pass on a good opportunity in favor of something better, though it is not yet accomplished. And what really makes this painful is that those with a vision often get accused of trying to do the very opposite of what their vision is really all about. Like Nehemiah, for example. He had walked away from an influential role in Susa. He arrives in Jerusalem and refuses to exploit his position as governor, not even accepting the food allotment that had been set aside for him. And yet, he's being accused of being power hungry. I've seen this so many times. And this dynamic is why painful criticism is often even more painful than you might otherwise think, and often harder to ignore, and why it often is very emotional. Because you're not just being accused, you're actually being accused of the very thing you're trying so hard not to do. And I don't care who you are, that stuff hurts. And when you hurt, you get angry. And when you get angry, your vision gets blurry. You see, anger is a form of focus, and that's why anger can become so distracting. The emotions your critics dredge up because of the words they choose to use about you, those emotions distract you from the vision God has given you. Now just think about this. What could have been more irritating to Nehemiah than to be accused of being on a power trip? So Sanballat hits the bullseye. And to make it even worse, he did the ancient equivalent of posting it on Facebook. No wonder Nehemiah was livid. But instead of grabbing a sword, climbing down off the wall, and stomping up to find slimy Sandy, Nehemiah funnels his frustrations right back to God by praying, God, strengthen my hands. In other words, you're going to have to guard my reputation, Lord, because I got to do what you have sent me to do. I plead with you, do not be distracted by criticism. Instead, learn to take whatever frustration you may have. Take that anger to the one who got you in this mess in the first place. Time alone will decide who was right. So the worst thing you can do is allow your anger to get you off focus. After more than 40 years in the ministry, I got to say to my regret, I wasted way too much time in my early years trying to answer critics and trying to track down divisive rumors. How much wiser I became when I finally learned to just pour out my heart to the Father and let Him defend me, and instead just stay up on the wall and do the work He called me to do. Now there's another dynamic in play, because not only will you be accused of the very thing you're trying so hard not to do, you will also be accused of whatever your accusers are themselves guilty of. Take Sanballat. You want to talk about Mr. Power Hungry. The reason he's so miffed is because Nehemiah's success is threatening his plan. So he does what so many critics still do today. He assumed of Nehemiah what was true of himself. Why, of course, Nehemiah could only be doing this out of his own self-interests. Why else would he be so committed to rebuilding this wall? People with impure motives love to question other people's motives. Have you noticed? It's called projection. And since their own actions are driven by selfish ambition, they assume yours must be too. And you can't really convince them otherwise, and I don't care how hard you try, so there's no reason to try. Instead, just pour out your frustration to the Father and keep building. Several years ago, a man who was the first person in the church I served in Indiana to come and welcome me and my family also became the first individual and family that we hung out with. Except his kids were several years older than our kids, and as the church grew and as our kids grew, we began to drift. I thought it was a very natural transition. He thought I was changing, and worse, getting too big for my britches. So unbeknownst to me, he started taking notes on my life, all related to stuff that he didn't think I ought to be doing. In fact, he became so contentious at this level, we finally realized we got to get everybody together. So there were some mediators that brought the two of us into a room so that we could find a way through without slugging each other. So imagine my surprise when he walks into the room with a shoebox filled with little scraps of paper. Notations, dates, quotes, all written on the back of envelopes and legal pads and paper napkins. I knew this is going to get nasty. And one by one, he exposed to the whole room everything he saw as my failures over the past 18 years of my life. Did it hurt? Now, that's a stupid question. Of course it hurt. Was I angry? If you know me, you know the answer. Until I realized he thinks he's got the goods on me, but I've done way worse than he knows about. But really, who does this stuff? Who are these hurtful people? And why are they so vicious? I don't know. But here's what I do know. The Lord will handle it. I don't know when and I don't know how, but I know that He will. So in the meantime, I've learned that God wants you and me to do exactly what Nehemiah did, which was also what Jesus did Remember, when they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. In other words, he waited for the Father to defend him. He quietly and submissively absorbed all of the abuse and then said, "Father, I'm going to trust you to handle this, because if I handle it, it's going to get bloody." And that's the challenge. When you and I get knocked down because somebody is driven to hurt us, and we're lying face down in the mud, and we stagger back to our feet only to get knocked down again, and we take hit after hit after hit till our faces are bloodied and bruised, our front teeth are knocked out, and our eyes are practically swollen shut, in that moment, God still wants us to say, as Job said, "Though he slay me, still will I trust him." And then to pray, just as Nehemiah prayed, "Lord, I'm choosing forgiveness. And no matter why whoever has tried to hurt me, I'm releasing all of that hurt into your care, because I'm learning, Lord, criticism is a part of the race. So just like Nehemiah and just like Jesus, I'm not going to seek my own revenge. I'm not going to get vindictive. I'm not going to get depressed. I'm not going to get whiny and super sensitive. I'm going to trust you. So, Lord, make this right." Now, I got to keep it real. There were times when anger still got the best of me. But then I'd come to my senses and I'd realize, "Wyatt, you can't fight this. You got to leave it to the Lord." Trouble is, my personality, I don't always want to wait for that pokey God of mine to balance the books for me. I want to help him and justify my feelings with, "Well, who does that jerk think he is? Given my whole life to serve the Lord. This isn't fair, God." I was whining kind of like that once when a friend of mine came up to me and said, "Erp, just shut up. I'm the pastor." He said, "Shut up. You're in a fight, dude. A fight against the forces of hell itself. What do you think was going to happen?" It's kind of like climbing into a boxing ring. They tape you up, they lace your gloves, they sound the bell, and then you walk out into the middle of the ring and the other guy takes a swing at you, cold cocks you right in the schnoz, and you race back to your trainer and go, "He hit me! Guy in that blue shorts over there, he hit me!" Well, what did you think he was going to do? Kiss you and call you mama? This is a fight, people! And the Bible says that our principal opponent, Satan himself, is moving about your life and mine like a roaring lion, seeking to devour us. And his stated goal, his primary vision, his purpose for being is to kill, steal, and destroy us. So he's going to send people into your life and into mine to hurt us. And sometimes they will be good people. You know what I've learned is the best way to silence a critic? See your vision all the way through to completion. In fact, if you look ahead, just five verses, Nehemiah's critics quickly changed their tune because the wall was completed, look at this, in record time, 52 days. When all our enemies heard about this, all of our surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they realized that, look at this, this work had been done with the help of our God. Gotta love that. Nehemiah's critics had lost their nerve because they realized God was in charge of this project. Listen to me, if God is the source of your vision, the day will come when even your harshest critics will have a tough time explaining away what God has done through you. Because it's hard, really hard, to argue with success, and even harder to argue with divine success. So don't let criticism distract you. If you gotta, go vent to the Father and then channel your excess energy right back into doing what He's called you to do. Because you're not accountable to your critics, even though they'll do everything imaginable to convince you that you are. You're accountable to the one who invited you in to partner with him in the creation of whatever it is he said you should make to be. The believers in Thessalonica were also under fire, but Paul urged them to keep their focus too, because get this, the one who calls you, he's faithful, and he will do it. And the same can be said of every truly divine vision. What God determines to be, it will be. Your job is to stay at the task. Years ago, I was really encouraged because I read a true story about a former Redskins quarterback. Redskins quarterback. Sonny Jurgensen, one of the most colorful athletes to ever play the game. Except Sonny was in the twilight of his career. The Redskins were awful, and Sonny was taking the bulk of the blame. The fans, the press, even the coaching staff were just laying it on Sonny. One time after a particularly brutal game, a reporter asked him, "Sonny, be honest. Doesn't all this criticism and the flack you've been taking and people up in the stands throwing stuff at you, doesn't it get to you?" Sonny leaned back and with that big gap-toothed grin of his said, "Nah, not really. I've been in this game long enough to know that every quarterback every week of the season spends his time either in the penthouse or in the outhouse. And you know what? He's right. If you are a leader, whether in ministry, football, whatever, you will spend the majority of your time either on the top or on the bottom. You'll either be the hero or the villain, respected or practically hated. And rarely is there very much in between. It's called the yo-yo of public opinion, and you're either going to be the target of cheap shots if you're on the bottom or great admiration if you're on the top. The outhouse, well, it stinks. I'm sorry. But it does. But that's where a great leader shows his or her truest colors and reveals the stuff we are truly made of. Now, Nehemiah faced a third distraction, and believe it or not, we're bringing it home now, okay? In addition to opportunities and criticism, he also faced a potentially life-threatening situation. Once again, Sanballat was the primary culprit, and his plan was to frighten Nehemiah into doing something stupid, something that would discredit him before his people. Once he realized that they weren't going to get Nehemiah to come out and engage with them, he sent somebody on the inside in to set a trap for him instead. Look at this. One day, I, Nehemiah, went to Shemaiah's house. Shemaiah said, "Let us meet in the house of the Lord, inside the temple. Let us close the temple doors, because men are coming to kill you by night. They're going to kill you." So Shemaiah, a Jew, invites Nehemiah over for a meeting. When Nehemiah arrives, Shemaiah tells this fabricated story about a plot on Nehemiah's life. Evidently, Sanballat was planning to send an assassin to Jerusalem to murder Nehemiah in his sleep. And Nehemiah's only hope, Shemaiah said, was to run to the temple, cling to the altar, which really sounded like a great plan, except only priests were allowed into that part of the temple, and Nehemiah was not a priest. So to run to the altar seeking safety would violate temple law in such a way that it would discredit Nehemiah before the Jews. Now, there were exceptions. There were some circumstances under which someone other than a priest could go into the temple for refuge. Like if somebody killed somebody and the victim had a relative who was bent on revenge, the murderer could run to the temple, cling to the altar for refuge, and be safe there until a judge was able to hear the case. So there were ways, but this wasn't one of them. See, Shemaiah was trying to trick Nehemiah into making a fear-based move that would violate the law, discredit him before his people, and undermine his authority as leader. Because word would eventually leak out that the governor was hiding in the temple from a would-be assassin, even though there was actually no assassin. But once again, Nehemiah refuses to be distracted. And talk about amazing. Look at his response. He says, "Should a man like me run away? Or go to the temple to save my life? I will not go." Now, had Nehemiah been in this great work only for his own interests, he would have had every reason to skedaddle. But Nehemiah had not only embraced God's vision had embraced Nehemiah. And so compared to the great work he was doing, the threat of being murdered, that was nothing. His response was just another way of saying, "I'm doing a great work and I cannot come down, not even to protect my own life. Something far bigger is at stake." He understood the magnitude of his vision. Should a man like me, one entrusted with such a sacred responsibility, should I abandon this task just to save my own life? He realized he was a part of something bigger than himself, that he was expendable, but the task was not. So he was not about to run. I think he probably suspected that this was another ruse, and in fact, eventually he realized that God had not sent him, that's Shemaiah, but that he had prophesied against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had actually hired to intimidate me so I'd commit a sin by doing this, and then they'd give me a bad name and discredit me. Every true vision will include elements that in the moment are yet unknown. And especially in the early stages of really any project, there's always way more unknown than what is known. And that unknown is fertile soil for fear. And that's why everybody who tries to accomplish whatever that vision might be for you will invariably face and have to wrestle with what-if scenarios. You ever been there? A single mom wants to please God with her life, but she battles every day with this as her greatest fear. What if God never sends somebody who will love me? A believer who's committed to integrity knows that he needs to quit his job, but what if I can't find another? And though we know that God wants us to buy these buildings, we need tenants to make the plan work. But what if no tenants come our way? And we got to raise capital to make the improvements that are needed, but what if we don't reach that goal? What ifs? And the biggest what if of all, the one that buries more great work than any other, what if we fail? Like anger, fear is another form of focus, and we can get so focused on what might be that we lose sight of what could be and what should be. And our fear can cause us to begin evaluating a project based on some bad thing that might happen rather than the good thing we believe is going to happen. But if we give in to fear, we shrink back from God's vision. We climb down the wall. We walk away from the great work and we run for the safety of an altar that is simply not ours to embrace. I plead with you, do not let the fear of the unknown in your life cause you to miss out on whatever God wants to do through you. Don't let fear rob you of your vision for your marriage or your finances or your career, your ministry, this church. Don't allow fear to distract you from what you believe both could and should be. I mean, if God has called us to a great work, don't you dare let anybody tell you it's not going to be done. Okay, we're closing. One of my all-time favorite preacher stories, and it's really cool because it also happens to be true, and that's not always the same thing. Minister friend of my dad's. His name was Pokey Miller. Now, there's a name. He just launched a building program. It was desperately needed. But there was one very old, very feisty man in the church who stood in stubborn opposition to the whole church leadership. And his objection threatened to sink the whole project. Well, Pokey was preaching one Sunday and mentioned how he believed that God was in the plan and that God would remove any opposition to what was so clearly his vision for that church. And as soon as he said that, that very feisty old geezer started to raise to his feet to object. And when he did, true story, his heart seized and he dropped stone dead on the church floor. Any guess as to whether the building got built? Okay, I'm not saying anything. And neither am I promising that if you have somebody plotting against the vision God has put on your life, that, you know, just wait, pray a little bit. Maybe God will ice him. I'm not saying that. But what I do want you to know is this. If you will take your cues from the Lord, if you will let Him fight your battles for you, in His good and perfect time, whatever it is that God has put on your heart to do, it will be done. It just will. Let's pray. God, you've just torn me up this week with this message. And I have a feeling you've torn some others up today. That's a good thing. That's a good thing because you have great works that need to be done. And you have callings on men and women all across this room. And I pray, Lord, that together we might decide that there's just absolutely no one and there's absolutely no thing that's going to stop me in the execution of your great vision. And so we celebrate the one who did it at the greatest sacrifice and to the greatest ends our world has ever and will ever know, Jesus. So, Lord, as we take in our hands a little piece of bread in this cup, before we close this service, Lord, may we have a time of such remembrance that we will not be distracted thinking about any other thing but what it is that Jesus refused to let happen in the execution of the vision you gave him. God, may we follow in his footsteps.